With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from the hottest summer on record here in 2020. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Iskov.
And with us today, we have a very special guest, very exciting guest, the inventor of podcasts, Karina Longworth. Thank you so much for being here. I mean, I say that half in jest, but you really are the inventor of podcasts.
And the
best in the game. You must remember this. You must remember Manson. Incredible series you just did on Song of the South. Incredibly relevant right now. I'm so happy to have you. Someone whose work I actually take in everything she does. So incredible. Literally incredible.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here, Karina. We really do appreciate it. And also I'm loving your other podcast that you're doing right now, that the movies got small.
Thanks. Yeah, we're actually on hiatus on that one for a few weeks, but I have a new season of You Must Remember This that's coming out right now.
Yes, on Polly Platt, which is also fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
Well, thank you again for being here and for talking to us about Summer of Sam and Spike Lee and all of that. But I just want to rewind for a quick second, just ask you where you were in 1999.
So I was in college in Chicago at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And do you guys know, I don't remember what month this movie came out.
Bill, you got that?
It was in July. It was a 4th of July movie.
Oh, then I was actually home in Los Angeles.
Hello?
But I don't remember the movie coming out at all. Can you guys still hear me?
Yeah, it didn't really make much of an impression at the time. We can hear you. Can you hear us?
Yeah, sorry. There was just a pause and I didn't know if you heard what I had just said.
Yeah, sorry.
Phil, there might be a delay on your side because I'm hearing her, I think, when she's talking, but I think you're behind.
Is there anything I can do, Ernie, or are we just at the whims of the internet gods right now? Okay, I'll take a second. So what I was saying is that it came out on July 2nd, and it opened in 8th place behind Wild Wild West, Big Daddy, and Tarzan. So it was kind of an odd time for this film to be released, to say the least. So you said you were in Cali. Did you see this film in 99 by any chance?
No, I don't remember it at all. It just wasn't on my radar, which is weird because I had seen a lot of Spike Lee movies by then. I definitely knew who he was, and I'd seen, definitely Do the Right Thing and Malcolm X. I'm not sure what else I had seen by that point, but, yeah, I think maybe that summer, that was sort of a summer where I was, I think, more into music than movies. And when I was going to the movies, I was going to the New Beverly and to LACMA to see, you know, retrospective stuff.
Yeah. Tough summer for music, though. A lot of boy band, a lot of Britney.
Oh, I was listening to Jade Tree Records, you know, I was listening to like Jazz to Brazil and Joan of Arc. So, and I remember going to, I don't even remember the name of it. It wasn't Lollapalooza. It was some other festival that was like a rock festival. And I think like Beck and Sonic Youth played.
Oh, well, that's good.
Beck
put out Midnight Vultures. That's that year.
Yeah.
So he was doing stuff. But oh my goodness, the Billboard Top 100 for the year is a graveyard of misbegotten Sonic nightmares. Just running down running down Spike real fast. So you have in 80-90 to Do the Right Thing, and then 92 is Malcolm X. Then he did a bunch of movies back to back to back that some people really like: Crooklyn Clockers, Girl Six. I don't know how many people love Girl Six, Crooklyn and Clockers, and they Get on the Bus, which some people like as well. That was 94 to 96. At that period, he kind of went a little bit under the radar. And if he had just stopped his career at that point, he still would have been one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. The year after he made, in 97, he made Four Little Girls, which is a documentary about the church bombing. I think it was in Alabama or Arkansas. And that was a kind of a huge movie. I believe he was nominated for Best Documentary for that. Then he got Game, which was a bit of a hit. And then Summer of Sam, which, you know, if you look at his filmography, part of the interesting, you know, the interesting story of Summer of Sam was this, you know, all the other films he made either had black protagonists or black co-protagonists. You have movies like Jungle Fever, Do the Right Thing, which had prominent color characters of other races. Summer of Sam, there's almost not a black character in the movie outside of kind of Spike himself.
So there's that one cop.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. It's the partner of Anthony LaPaglia.
Yeah.
Correct.
And so that was an unusual thing for Summer of Sam that I think people glommed onto that year. And I think it was almost like a sensory memory of Spike's time in the city. And I think it was 1977 when this all went down. So it was a bit of a departure for Spike and for Spike's fans. Too bad it was, you know, this movie and it didn't really have the
But I think there was also sort of there was an element of controversy around the film too, which is that the family members of the victims didn't want essentially a movie made about this, you know, about the Son of Sam. So the script, if I'm not mistaken, was much more about him. And then it became more about the area and the Bronx and sort of this cross-section of all these different cultures and this kind of dialed up hot summer and sort of the fear that came with the Son of Sam. It does feel like a project that no one kind of enjoyed making. It seems like a lot of the actors didn't get along. There was a lot of issues with that. I don't know if you read about that, Karina, or not.
No, I haven't really read about that. I mean, what I've read about is Michael Imperioli sort of, instigating the project in, I guess, a slightly different form because he actually knew somebody like the Adrian Brody character. And it was sort of about his memories of growing up during that time. And then also Spike had kind of shot his first movie in the summer of 1977 on the streets during the blackout.
Right.
And it was sort of about the blackout and disco. And it was called Last Hustle in Brooklyn. And I wish I could see it, but I can't find it.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, it is this film. I've gone through sort of a real kind of ups and downs in this movie over the last couple of weeks as I watched the film and I did some research on it. And it does feel like there is this reevaluation going on of this movie, at least online, in terms of the fact that some people feel like it's this sort of misbegotten or this forgotten masterpiece, or didn't get the you know, credit that it deserved at the time. I'm not entirely in that camp, but I do think that there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on in this movie. I'm just not sure that it ever fully capitalizes on all of these elements.
Yeah, I think that there is a good movie inside of it. Yeah. But unfortunately, the first hour is the most boring. And yeah. So it's like it takes a while. It took me a while to kind of like hook into what I found interesting about it, because I'm certainly not interested in John Leguizamo's marital problems. And no. Yeah. And so for me, I feel like there is something really fascinating in this evocation of the summer and what it felt like just to be so paranoid in the heat. And it's, you know, a kind of a different spin on the summer that you see in Do the Right Thing. And just this idea that, like, in that climate, you know, you have this punk rock friend and like you could become convinced that he is this murderer that's terrorizing the city. And then, you know, the sort of gay panic stuff is really fascinating, too. But, you know, sometimes it seems like Spike Lee's movies are sort of artificially long. And yeah. This is one where it feels like, you know, far be it for me to tell him that he needs to focus on like maybe three ideas instead of six. But I do feel like this movie just kind of takes a while to get to its good ideas.
You know, the problem is Malcolm X was so fucking good. So after that, I think he may have thought, I'll just do everything. I'll make every right. movie, everything, and yeah. it'll be as good as Malcolm X. Because Malcolm X is like a 3.5 hour perfect movie. It's really kind of hard to beat that.
Go ahead.
One thing I wanted to kind of note about this movie is I think this would be an amazing project today after what we're experiencing right now. Cause I couldn't help but see the parallels between the citywide panic, essentially, you know, citywide panic, citywide curfew, stay inside, and what we're experiencing right now. Mm-hmm. This is essentially a pandemic movie, right? So there is this ominous thing out in the city that could get you, that could kill you. Stay inside, be scared, start trying to scapegoat in our current environment. It's go online, go on to Reddit, see if anyone in your neighborhood has a history of this. I think
hate that, on people that wear masks right now.
I think that there are interesting parallels, and I think he is hitting on something in human nature that's kind of been, you kind of metastasized into some really disgusting things that are happening right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting, I don't disagree with that. I mean, I'll say that part of it too, watching this film now through the lens of, you know, what we're going through, it certainly did tap into stuff that that I think at the time probably just didn't speak to people to the same degree, perhaps. I mean, it's, you know, the movie has 51% from critics on Rotten Tomatoes and 60% from audiences. I mean, this movie was not embraced at the time. You know, a
it
lot
also
of people
has a D- cinema score, which is very, very low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's almost, I mean, as bad as it gets.
I mean, I think oftentimes critics like have either misunderstood or not given Spike the benefit of the doubt at all.
For sure.
But that cinema score is wild.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is, Karina? Why do you think that Spike has kind of been, Outside of the few obvious temples, Do the Right Thing and Malcolm X before this, I think there was a bit of a reassessment after, I'd say, 25th Hour. Mm-hmm. But before that, I agree with you. I feel like Spike's movies, particularly some of the like the masterpieces that don't get held up at masterpieces like Bamboozled and She's Gotta Have It, weren't treated as such. So I wonder what you think.
Well, I've actually been doing a lot of research about Spike because for this other project that I'm working on. And I think that She's Gotta Have It actually did get pretty good critical reception. What, you know, I think what's kind of started what I'm talking about is School Days. And what it seems like now is, you know, barely veiled racism in the reviews of people being like, how dare this kid, you know, they call him a kid, you know, and the implication is black kid. Yeah. How dare this kid, you know, think he's Vincent Minnelli and think he's, you know, capable of doing, you know, this great storied Hollywood genre of the musical. And then I think that kind of, you know, spiral, that kind of element of the critical response kind of spirals into, you know, he's stepping out of his place, you know. So it's racism, I think. But then maybe it just kind of gets codified into, like, you know, sort of, you know, honestly, like what I was just saying of, like, these movies are a little out of control, right? Like they're,
right,
they're, you know, there's this sense of, like, he's trying to do too much, and he's trying to he's sort of asking too much of the audience.
I mean, it's interesting too, because it feels like, you know, Spike just released a film on Netflix a couple weeks ago called The Five Bloods, which I quite liked and has been getting a lot of critical acclaim for the most part. But it is also a movie that feels like five movies or six movies even kind of jammed into one. But people seem to be giving him a lot of credit for that this time around, as opposed to in the past, yeah, when it feels like he was lambasted for that.
Well, I think sometimes it works better than other times. I really like The Five Bloods too, and I think, right, that the sort of journey aspect of that film gives it a container.
Right.
And I feel the same way about School Days, to be honest. I really love School Days, and I think that the fact that it's contained into a weekend allows him to kind of do everything, because there's, you know, sort of a whisper of a structure there. And maybe the idea with Summer of Sam is that the structure was going to be this summer leading up to Berkowitz getting arrested. But for me, it doesn't quite work in the same way.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, I really think the pacing really hurts it, to your point earlier, Karina. Like that first 45 minutes to an hour is, it's a slog, you know, and the movie just doesn't need to be this long. It is a little bit unwieldy. But I would also say too, I mean, not to, you know, there are a lot of good things about it as well. I mean, I think there are a lot of really strong performances in it. I think it's, you know, he's very good at needle drops and the music cues and the way he folds music into it, I think, is really impressive. It's very well shot, but, yeah, it definitely feels a little all over the place.
I think so much of that has to do with Leguizamo's character, though. It's a very odd way into the story, in my opinion. Particularly, you know, considering all the kind of interesting characters there and all the interesting characters in the city, at any given time, you know, Jimmy Breslin comes on and says there's 8 million stories in the city. And for those of you who don't know who Jimmy Breslin is, he's a old New York, like, newsman who is in this movie in the beginning and the end, basically saying, "I love and hate New York in equal measure," which is, I think, how all New Yorkers feel about New York. And he's the one who coined the phrase, "There are 18 million stories in the naked city." Well, why Leguizamo's is my question. Like, why this one who has such a kind of rote story about, you know, the guy who can't stop screwing around on his wife, and the guy who kind of turns to, you know, this lets paranoia and almost peer pressure take over him and turn against his best friend. I think we could have found a more interesting protagonist.
Well, yeah, also, just like, I don't even know that the problem is with the protagonist. The problem is just, like, kind of following him on this journey of infidelity. And you know, I think the Plato's retreat scene is so unnecessary.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mira Sorvino would agree with you. she talked in the press about how she was not a fan of shooting that scene. I mean, it sort of comes back to the repetition of his character as well. I feel like we hear him say the same things a lot. It feels like there just isn't a lot there, truthfully. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, is there something to be said for the fact that, I don't know. Maybe he's just not that interesting a character. I'm not sure that he is.
Me neither.
I want to give a synopsis real quick for our listeners who maybe have not seen Summer of Sam. During the summer of 1977, a killer known as the Son of Sam keeps all of New York on edge with a series of brutal murders. The philandering Vinny, played by John Leguizamo, unwittingly almost becomes a victim of this of the psychopath, and soon he and numerous people in his orbit, including his wife Diana, played by Mira Sorvino, his punk rock friend Richie, played by Adrian Brody, and aspiring porn star Ruby, played by Jennifer Esposito, are trying to figure out the identity of the killer before it's too late. The movie was written by Victor Coliccio, Michael Imperioli, and Spike Lee. It was obviously directed by Spike Lee. It opened on January 2nd, 1999, in eighth place behind Wild Wild West, Big Daddy, and Tarzan with $2 million. It would go on to make 19 on a $22 million budget. I have to say, I'm kind of, I know the Touchstone was an imprint of Disney, and it's a little surprising that they thought this film was going to work in the summer. I mean, I get that it's got summer in the title, but I don't know.
Well, Spike was a brand name, right? Spike did just do He Got Game. He Got Game was a pretty big hit. Yeah. You know, Spike.
Yeah, it was
Spike,
like his first kind of big box office hit in a long time. So
it's true.
There might have been this sense that like Spike was back.
I think there was. I think at this point, to at least younger audiences, I remember I really loved everything Spike was doing at the time. I was excited whenever he put out a movie. It really felt like he kind of belonged to. Even though I think he's like 60 now, it really felt like he kind of belonged to our generation to some extent. So this was a bit of a bummer. Like that's really what it comes down to for me. Like,
yeah,
this was a bit of a bummer in that, you know, with a Spike Lee movie, you expect it to be kind of bombastic and exciting and daring and edgy and going places you don't see movies go before, while also kind of learning something about the culture, learning something about America. Like Defy Blood says that incredibly. Do the Right Thing does that incredibly. Malcolm X says that incredibly. And this just doesn't feel quite the same. This feels down and dour. And, you know, I do wonder, because when you said earlier, the original script focused more on the Son of Sam. Defy Bloods was written 7 years ago by two white writers about five white characters. And it seems like it wasn't all that different from Triple Frontier. Nothing against Triple Frontier, but it feels like it wasn't all that different from, you know, a bunch of former GIs go to where they, you know, have some
sure.
treasure hidden and try to bring it home.
Yep.
Spike is the one who saw that this would be a far more interesting story telling it through the lens of five very different African-American characters. I do feel like that's a perspective I haven't seen, and you get glimpses of it, right? You get glimpses of it here when there's the blackout and there's the riot in Harlem and the police are all over it. Meanwhile, in, you know, I guess it's the Lower East Side where this takes place, the police are literally asking the criminals to solve the crime for them. The police are literally going to the mob bosses and being like, can you guys solve this for us? So
yeah.
There certainly is some elements of privilege and some elements of white supremacy being borne out in this script, but I think that there's a lot. I think there's a lot more to be mined there, and I think we waste a lot of our time talking about these characters who I don't find particularly compelling. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't disagree. I'll say this though. I mean, I liked Richie and Ruby. I thought that Adrian Brody and Jennifer Esposito were more interesting characters. I thought they were portrayed, or at least their performances were quite strong. It certainly just felt a little bit more interesting to me. That whole punk rock sort of underground component was, I mean, I found it interesting,
cool.
And I thought it was well executed for the most part. It certainly was more interesting, than Vinny's Infidelity, which feels, as I said, repetitive, and we've been there before. We've seen that before.
Although, I mean, I
do
want to
just
say,
very quickly read. Sorry,
I didn't realize you were still talking. I don't know.
No, go ahead. Sorry, please. Yeah.
I have to say that I think Bebe Neuwirth is like the MVP of this movie.
She's the MVP of everything she's
in. I was just going to say, she's just
like,
always
Neuwirth
the MVP.
And her abs. She's so ripped.
Yeah.
She's phenomenal. She's fantastic. I mean, bringing her up, I have to talk about very briefly apparently there was a lot of Spike wanted a lot of improvisation going on in this film. He wanted to create sort of a, I guess, some sort of electric energy or what have you. And perhaps that's something that he does in his other films. I'm not sure. But when Vinny pours the coffee on her head, that was apparently improvised. When he spit at Mira Sorvino in their fight in the car, also improvised. You know, it creates an energy, to be sure. I'm not sure that I think it's the best energy to have on your set, but it does do something.
I love John Leguizamo as an actor. I hope this mm-hmm. doesn't sound like I hate him as an actor. I think he's one of my favorite actors. And, you know, his performance in Moulin Rouge is like one of my favorite performances. I think he's like beyond brilliant. So it's nothing against Leguizamo. And I think that he's a good guy to give that kind of leeway to. I think that he, you know, is totally in control of what he's doing at all times. Again, I'm just not that much. I'm not that sure that, you know, the skeleton this is all hanging off of is all that interesting.
Right. I mean, I listen, I'm not sitting here shitting on John Leguizamo. I think that there's something to be said for the energy he brings to the character, for sure. And I don't disagree that giving him some rope is necessarily a bad thing. I don't know if I was an actor and he turned and spit on me during a take, I'd be all that into it. But that's just me.
Not, yeah, I don't know that that's specific to Leguizamo. I don't know that
exactly, you
know, necessarily want that, especially now.
I'd be okay.
Hopefully nobody ever spits on anybody ever again.
So I just want to very quickly read a little bit of Roger Ebert's review, because he was quite a big fan of this film, and I feel like he brings up some interesting ideas. He gave it 3.5 out of 4 stars. He says, Summer of Sam is the first film with no major African-American characters in a Spike Lee movie, but it has themes familiar to blacks and other minorities, scapegoating. In the summer of 77, when New York City was gripped by paranoid fear of the serial killer who called himself the Son of Sam, the residents of an Italian-American neighborhood in the Bronx are looking for a suspect. Anyone who stands out from the crowd is a candidate. Lee's best films thrum with a wound-up energy, and Summer of Sam vibrates with guilt, fear, and lust. It's not about the killer, but about his victims, not those he murdered, but those whose overheated imaginations bloomed into a lynch mob mentality. Summer of Sam is like a companion piece to Lee's Do the Right Thing. In a different neighborhood, in a different summer, the same process takes place. The neighborhood feels threatened and needs to protect its fear of an outsider. It's often lamented that in modern city neighborhoods, people don't get to know their neighbors. That might be a blessing in disguise. I mean, I think that there is something to be said for the scapegoating and the cultural kind of Venn diagram that's going on in this film. Again, I'm not sure that it totally works, but I do think that it's interesting, and I do think that especially now it's you know, it feels very, you know, pertinent.
It does.
What do you think about the last line of that review? Phil, would you mind reading it again?
Absolutely. It's often lamented that in modern city neighborhoods, people don't get to know their neighbors. That may be a blessing in disguise.
That's pretty loaded.
It's very loaded.
It's a pretty loaded button there, Raj. I think that's interesting though, and no comment on the value of that statement. I think that's an interesting way to look at this versus Do the Right Thing. Do the Right Thing obviously takes place in a very multicultural neighborhood. That's kind of the point of the movie. This does make me think that Spike might be trying to say, all right, what happens if it's nothing but, you know, one race of people? What happens then when put under pressure, when put in the pressure cooker of the pressure cooker of 100 degree days, the pressure cooker of a madman on the loose? Where do you turn then? And I think
the answer.
Go ahead.
The answer seems to be you find an other.
Right.
Even if it's not somebody who looks that, I mean, I guess one of the things they're sort of picking on Adrian Brody for is that he looks so quote unquote scary, yeah. But you know, it's not that he's a different race. He grew up with them, you know, it's just that he's the freak, you know, in the group. And yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if Spike is saying that's human nature or if that's white nature, but.
Well, it's Ricky's character, Adrian Brody. It's also the gay character that they go after first. So yeah. I agree with you. I think it is a matter of looking at the other. And I think we've seen that before. I mean, this is Lord of the Flies, right? They go right after Piggy because he's fat and has asthma. Yeah. So I think he, at the very least, he is saying it's white human nature. I don't know. But is it human nature or white human nature? You guys want to have that conversation?
I'll say this. I do feel like it really is anyone that is even remotely different, or I mean, even they attack Ruby. I mean, because she's quote unquote promiscuous, I guess. I mean, they attack essentially anyone that doesn't fit a very rigid idea of, I don't know, a person, perhaps a white person. I'm not sure.
We see this in a lot of depictions of Italian Americans. Actually, you see it up and down The Sopranos.
Sure.
You know, you see it. You know, you see it up and down The Godfather. You see it a lot. I think, and I don't know. Is that offensive? Is that real? Is that fair? Is that a fair thing to put onto this particular culture? Because I do think that I've seen it a lot with Italian Americans in a way that you see it obviously with kind of your white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, your Bible thumpers. Mm-hmm. But that certainly feels like punching up in America. Is it the same thing here? I'm genuinely trying to kind of dissect what we're discussing and what is trying to be said here, and whether or not it's fair, whether or not it's right, whether or not we're comfortable with it. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure that I think part of the issue that we seem to be circling is that I'm not sure that the film really does kind of lock into what it's trying to say. It does feel a little bit muddy, and it does feel as though perhaps it's trying to say a lot of things, and that's why some of the message gets lost. I want to read a quick little thing from Little White Lies did a piece on Summer of Sam, which I think speaks to what we're talking about a little bit and brings something else into it, which I think is interesting. Basically, they say, how can you not be cynical in a society that is so unfair? For all the attempts to control safety and comfort, the world doesn't offer much consolation. The systems in place, be it religion, the justice system, or democracy, are often the sources of deep anguish and suffering. Characters reaching for opportunities they can't get at collectively, traumatized not only by Son of Sam, but by society itself. In a sense, this is Lee's obsession. Legacies of trauma passed down. Even if the status quo is often weaponized against the citizenry, for most, it is worth upholding as a way to maintain some semblance of self, often through violence and self-annihilation. I think there's something there in terms of Spike Lee's films often talking about trauma passed down. Do you see that, Karina?
Yeah, I mean, I think for sure. But I also think that his movies are, and one thing that's interesting about the fact that he's like now made two period pieces in a row is that he always seems to be really interested in evoking a present moment.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, I don't think that the characters are aware, you know, that they're victims of trauma being passed down. They're sort of almost always hyper-focused on what's happening right now or in their moment.
Yeah.
No, totally. I also think, you know, something that this made me think of something to piggyback on what you're saying, Karina, about this. I don't know that there's a filmmaker that uses historical footage, if you will, better than Spike Lee does. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just completely understands how to hammer home something that's happening now by showing you something that's happened in the past. You know, obviously the idea of like, we haven't learned anything and we're unfortunately repeating the past constantly, but he uses it so well. I mean, it works in this as well. But yeah. I mean, obviously,
vice
I think
versa in the Black case of Black.
Sorry, go ahead.
Black Klansman's vice versa, right? Black Klansman is taking a period piece and then putting modern footage over that, and that's kind
which
of thrilling too.
Which he did in Malcolm X as well with the Rodney King footage.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional.
Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah. Something that struck me, and that I keep coming back to is this idea that the cops went to the mob for help to find this killer, and the kind of psychology of that, and the psychology of who the cops respect, who the cops look to as someone who can help them police the neighborhood. And it kind of does speak to what you were talking about, that that excerpt you just pulled, Phil, the idea of violence, the idea of ruling through violence and ruling through fear and violent people respecting violent people. And I think that, you know, I know this for a fact. I have a relative who's a police officer, and there is a lot of coordination between police officers and gangs in inner cities, particularly right now. And I think that that's kind of scary, that the people who tend to have some respect from law officers, from law enforcement officers, are the people who also rule with violence in their communities. So I think that there's something going on in Summer of Sam that speaks to that, speaks to, okay, you're just kind of taking one gun-toting authority, replacing it with another gun-toting authority. And these people are kind of talking to each other at a level that average day citizens don't can't understand or they're not privy to.
But then there's also, it's almost like there's different tiers of that, you know. It kind of gets smaller and smaller, like once you get down to like the guys sort of hanging out at the end of the street, and like the guy who sells weed is sort of the leader of that team.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. It's a very, I mean, cliquey movie, in the sense that people have these little sort of microcosms that they've created for themselves and are very protective of them. It's, you know, I sort of, what did you think of the casting of some of the actors in it? Did you feel like, because there was a lot of kind of shifting going on with some of the roles? Deanna was originally written for Jennifer Esposito, and then she became Ruby after Sarah Michelle Gellar passed on the, it's just like, it all kind of feels odd to me. I don't know how you felt about it.
Oh, right. There is that moment where Sarah Michelle Gellar was a thing. Can you imagine if she had been in this movie and then Cruel Intentions right after that?
Yeah. And then Simply Irresistible.
So I agree that I think that Adrian Brody and Jennifer Esposito are kind of the most interesting main characters. And I really like both of those performances. I was so happy to see Ben Gazzara show up.
Mm-hmm.
He always
great.
Makes everything better.
Yep.
I don't totally buy Anthony LaPaglia's New York accent.
Me neither. Speaking my language. I went 20 minutes on Russell Crowe's American accent last episode. So
in the Insider. Yeah.
Wow. I just don't know about these Australians coming in and talking like a tough guy for New York. I don't know. But.
Look, I'm just like, I am somebody who's half English, and I am tired of English people and Australian people taking American jobs.
Yeah.
You know, I can say that because I'm one of them, but I'm so tired of British people being cast as non-British people. For me, the high point was Felicity Jones playing Ruth Bader Ginsburg, because I'm also half Jewish. So it's like, it's, you know,
that's
it's not great. But what were you talking about? Casting?
The casting. Yeah. Just, I mean, I thought that Mira Sorvino is, I mean, she's just not given really much to do. Like, she really only has kind of two scenes where she kind of stands up for herself a little bit.
Yeah, and there's a lot of sort of unmodulated yelling.
yes.
But, you know, I think that it's still, even though I don't think it's like a particularly nuanced performance, you still watch it and you're like, huh, she stopped working at some point. Why was that? Oh, yeah, Harvey Weinstein. Yeah. So it does feel like, it does remind you that there's a loss there.
Well, Mira Sorvino totally. Just had this, the pre-Harvey Weinstein revelations. Mira Sorvino kind of had this Marissa Tomei-esque, she won an Oscar by accident and she's not actually good narrative. And that only seems to fall on actresses, not, you know, female actors, not male actors. And
honestly,
now
I think people say that about Adrian Brody.
It might be true about him, but no,
that's kind of true. That's kind of true. Yeah.
Well, you know, Adrian Brody, I mean, I'm going to put a pin in Adrian Brody for a second, but I do think that you're completely right that, that I think Mira Sorvino is actually, you know, very clearly a very talented actress. She does. You take Mighty Aphrodite, Romy Michelle, this, she's doing three completely different things. I actually found her really compelling in this movie. I really like the relationship with her and Leguizamo. I love the scene in the car when she, you know, when they're basically kicking each other out.
Mm-hmm. That's a great
I
scene.
Thought it was really great. And I do feel like we really did lose something. We lost 15 years of her life because she was blacklisted by a rapist. So yeah, the Adrian Brody thing, Adrian Brody did something really weird at the Oscars. You guys remember
when he kissed her?
Come
when
on.
He kissed Halle Berry?
Yeah. Come on, man. You don't get to just go up and kiss people. So, I don't know. You don't want to judge someone based on one moment or their worst moment, but that speaks to something that you kind of get through his characters. I think often, not, you know, the Pianist notwithstanding, and also weird movie to win an Oscar for, but it does speak to something about his characters, which is I do feel a sense of entitlement coming out of him that undercuts this performance a little bit for me. Like I didn't love his performance as Ricky because I can't get Adrian Brody, privileged guy, out of my head. I think that there's a darker, nastier, more lived-in performance here that could have been delivered by someone else. So,
well, it's interesting because in some of the reading, apparently Leonardo DiCaprio was circling the role at one point in his sort of post-Titanic wanting to shake things up. Like he almost was an American Psycho. It was clear that he just wanted to get out of the sort of teen heartthrob and ended up doing everyone's favorite movie, The Beach. But I don't know that he would have been right for this, but it's interesting to think about. I mean, I don't know. It's an interesting role. I don't disagree with you, Kenny. I think that Adrian Brody is, I think he's good in the movie, but I never forgot it was Adrian Brody, if that's what you're getting at.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, I think the thing about Adrian Brody is he's actually a leading man. But because he has a big nose, like people try to cast him as, you know, sort of the secondary character or the anti-hero or the antagonist. And so he plays this role like he's the protagonist. But the actual protagonist of the movie, I think, is supposed to be Leguizamo.
Yep.
And so it undercuts the paranoia of the other characters because you don't believe that he's Son of Sam. You know, you don't believe that he has that in him at all.
Totally.
I completely agree. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. It's, yeah. Speaking of his nose, it was apparently broken during the final climactic scene, too, just FYI. So there you go. Yeah. I mean, also, John Turturro apparently is the voice of the dog.
Just amazing. Favorite scene in the movie. I mean, besides for any scene involving Bebe Neuwirth.
So
the funny thing is, all of a sudden, Sam stuff really worked well for me. who's the actor from The Wire, from The Practice, who plays him?
Balducci, is that his name?
Michael Balducci.
Yeah,
I love him in The Practice. But all that stuff really kind of worked well for me. I think that is kind of what what's his name, David Berkowitz, actually kind of felt like, and actually kind of, he didn't really look like him, but kind of had the same kind of vibe. So,
but wait, can I? I'm sorry, we breezed past this. But did you guys like the dog scene? Did the dog scene work for you guys?
I loved it. Okay. Oh my God. I didn't really like the Berkowitz Lair stuff at all. Like, but when the dog starts talking, it takes a movie to this level of lunacy that I can really get into, because I think a lot of the movie feels a little too self-serious.
Right, right.
But when you bring in, you know, the delusion of a talking dog, that that really worked for me. Because that's like this. That's kind of on the same level for me as like the fight when in the car, you know, like there's kind of just like a level of sort of like heightened, you know, nuttiness that I think the movie kind of needs more of if it's going to be about people going crazy in 105 degree heat with a killer around.
You know, there's something kind of, I agree with you. There's something.
I completely agree with that. Yeah.
There's something kind of sneakily hilarious about the dog scene. And I like all the Son of Sam stuff. Because it speaks to the razor's edge society sits on. That one lunatic's tearing down the walls of his apartment, hearing the voice of a dog, can totally destroy a city for a period of time. You know what I mean? Like, it's we're so close to mayhem at all moments.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I guess I just, there's... So I did see this in the theater, and I remember the dog scene vividly because a lot of people laughed in the theater. And I think part of it is, and this isn't to say that the scene doesn't, it is funny. It is funny. It's not to say that it doesn't work, but it does feel, to your point, Karina, like I wish there was more of that in the film. I think the audience was jarred by it, is I guess what I'm getting at, because it felt so kind of from a different movie.
Right.
You know, this also brings me to sort of a question I have for you, Karina, about film stocks and about like the arbitrary choices that Spike seems to have sometimes in terms of changing film stocks or saturation levels or what have you. It does seem like he uses it pretty liberally in the Son of Sam stuff to sort of make it stand out. But then there's also times where like Vinny and Donna are dancing by themselves and all of a sudden it just changes film stocks. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, first of all, I think this movie looks great. I think that, you know, cinematographer Ellen Kuras did an awesome job, especially in the scenes where it seems like what Lee is trying to do is pay homage to Scorsese. You know, I mean, I think there's a lot of sort of ersatz Scorsese in this. But, you know, one thing that's been interesting in doing research about Spike is that it seems like he felt like there was a double standard, you know, between him and a lot of white directors. But he cites Oliver Stone a lot in interviews, like Oliver Stone got this much money to make JFK and I only got this much to make Malcolm X. And then there's a period where he's like, you know, I can mix up film stocks and you know, I can have a movie have three different distinct looks, like if Oliver Stone can, you know, like you guys don't criticize him for doing that. You criticize me for doing it.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I can absolutely see that. And you know, we talked about Any Given Sunday because that was a 99 movie, a Oliver Stone movie dialed up to 11 for sure.
But... Which I love and think is a brilliant masterpiece.
What are your thoughts on Any Given Sunday, Karina?
I haven't seen it. I'm actually like not really an Oliver Stone completist because I just always, I don't know, when I you know, growing up in the 90s, I was like, that guy, really? Sure. I just had like kind of an allergic reaction to his personality. Yeah. And then I haven't really gone back. But he's one of those people where I feel like at some point I will just spend a summer watching Oliver Stone movies, whether I like it or not.
That sounds like a sociological experiment, but sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that I've not seen all of his films. I think I've probably seen about half of them, maybe two-thirds of them. But that's a really interesting connection, because I do feel like Spike at times, I don't mean to say it's arbitrary. I'm sure it's thoughtful in the way that he uses these things, and I'm sure that it has a point. But sometimes it just feels like this will look cool. Which I mean, is in and of itself, I guess, not necessarily a bad thing. The film does look beautiful. It does have a lot of sort of Robert Richardson hot lighting and various sort of things that have been attributed to Scorsese over the last 20 years or so. But overall, did you like the style of it? Did you feel like the music worked? I thought that some of the music cues were pretty great, but I don't know how you felt about it.
Yeah, I definitely did. And I watched Crooklyn for the first time a couple of weeks ago, and I think Crooklyn's a movie that you know, for the first 45 minutes, I was like, is this a soundtrack in search of a movie? And then I kind of realized the extent to which Spike was often using these super classic needle drops, ironically.
Right.
And I think he does the same thing here really effectively.
Definitely.
He's doing it in Defy Bloods, too. It's and I think he does it in Black Klansman as well. It's kind of a hallmark of Spike. Repurposing music that has been repurposed by white culture. I think that's an interesting kind of comment.
And I actually really like the punk rock song.
I love
my late term abortion.
You like their band?
I cannot believe that band is called Late Term Abortion. I love it.
He really did nail that. Like that. I'm actually like super into depictions of like late 70s, early 80s New York punk rock. I don't think it gets depicted nearly enough, and I find them always kind of viscerally thrilling to be in that world, particularly the CBG.
Just like in 200 Cigarettes? You didn't think that was a great depiction?
No, I loved it in 200 Cigarettes. I feel like I would...
Is that a 1999
I thought that
movie?
Was great.
It is. We have done that one, yeah.
We did that one twice.
Well, because... Well, we did it twice because we got Betsy Beers to come on, who produced it. So she came on to talk about it. So that was, we felt like, you know, but it is a 99 movie. I want to just quickly talk about, because we've hit a lot of the plot, but one thing that I do think is worth noting is Vinny almost dying early in the film. Unbeknownst to him, he's basically almost killed by the Son of Sam, and it gives him sort of this existential crisis that he's going through for the rest of the film. But it starts in an interesting place for Vinny. It just gets a little bit repetitive, but I do feel like the killings in this film are quite graphic. And I don't know that it's, are they effective, I guess, is sort of what I'm getting at. Like, I think about a film like Zodiac, which...
Yeah, they're all dead.
I understand that. Yeah. Thank you, Kenny.
you're welcome.
I appreciate that. I guess what I mean is, and it's unfair. I mean, it is unfair to compare this film to Zodiac, which I think is a vastly superior film. But there is sort of this theatricality to the way that these people are killed that I do wonder whether or not is doing the film a disservice.
That's how they were killed.
I don't know about that.
Okay.
All right, so just to bring up a less lauded serial killer movie that I quite like, Copycat. It was Copycat. I don't know if you remember what Copycat's about, but Copycat came out right around the same year as I think it was either the same year or a year after Seven. And I was very young. I was in my early teens, and everything that I knew about serial killers from that point up to that point came from Seven and Copycat. So what was so startling about Copycat, if you remember the film,
Say Copycat more, please? You're not saying Copycat enough.
I'm 99% sure we've done this bit before where I go Copycat, Copycat, yeah, Copycat, Copycat.
We have. We really have. Yeah.
So the thing that I like about Copycat is it sounds like a terrible feline superhero.
Yeah. Sure.
Is that he goes, it's a terrible movie. The killer copies serial killer styles. And most of the serial killers have different styles. Part of being a serial killer is generally there's a sexual component to it. So it's usually very intimate, strangling or stabbing or things like that. The Son of Sam killings were really not intimate. They were really not sexual. They were really kind of gross and graphic and gruesome like this. It was knock, knock, blow your head off. And that is, to me, very effective from a serial killer, because there's something about serial killers that makes you feel like you can get away. If you pick up on what they're doing, if you pick up on who they are and where they're trying to lure you in, and you can fight them off. I mean, we saw this in that the movie The Bone Collector. You can fight them off usually because they're usually trying to kill you with their hands. But the knock knock blow your head off at a gas station is scary as shit.
I didn't mean to suggest that it's not scary. I guess my question was more sort of about, and this is maybe a bigger question in terms of, when you make a movie about a serial killer, are you aggrandizing them? Are you making them quote unquote I don't want to say seem cool, because I don't think that's what this film is doing, but is there some legitimacy to the idea of us not putting this stuff on film? I mean, Karina, you've obviously, I mean, do you feel like there's a connection there? Do you feel like that's valid, or should films not be, you know, should they be allowed to depict however they want to depict these things?
Yeah, I think it has to be up to the filmmaker. I don't think there should be any hard and fast rules. It sort of depends on what you're, you know, as a filmmaker, what you're more interested in. Are you interested in the gore? Do you think that it's in... I'm sorry that my doorbell's ringing. Somebody else will get that. Do you think that what's important is the gore, or is what's do you feel like the viewer needs to see how brutal these murders are in order to understand the paranoia? Another right. filmmaker might have decided that the murders, you know, you don't see them and that makes them scarier. I don't know. I didn't have a problem with the way that they were depicted in this film. I did feel like, I mean, we already talked about it, but I did feel like the Berkowitz and his lair stuff was kind of excessive. And once I had seen that twice, I didn't really need to see it again.
Phil, speaking to what you're talking about, you know, the famous Son of Sam case, aside right. from his murder cases, was that he was going to write a tell-all, a memoir. And he was going to profit from it. I believe he may have actually written and profited from it. And the families of the deceased sued him, and you can't do that anymore. So right. there is certainly an element of, at least the state of New York decided there is a point where it's too far, right? There is a point where where the person who committed the murders can no longer profit off of those murders. Phil, we have these conversations all the time, you and
we
I.
We do.
about what to show and what not to show, what kind of is responsible and what's yeah. irresponsible. And I do wonder, you know, is there a line for you, Karina? Back to Phil's original question, how do you feel about serial killer movies in general? Do you feel in any way whatsoever? I don't want to lead you, because I have my take, and I don't want to put you down that road, but
I mean, do you mean specifically about real serial killers, or?
Well, there are two questions, right? One is real serial killers, if real crime should be depicted. Another one is just kind of violence in general, gruesome violence in general. Is there a point where it does more harm than good?
I'm sorry, one second. I have to respond to a text because the guy who's supposed to fix the internet is here.
Okay, no worries, of course.
She's going to settle this argument once and for all, Phil.
The suspense is killing me.
You should know the last time we had this argument, it ended with, we have to agree to disagree. I love you.
That's how most of our arguments end, by the way.
I don't know that I should even really say anything, because I don't think I've thought about serial killer movies at all in my life.
Okay.
You guys obviously have.
Well, it's actually not serial killer movies that we're talking about. In general, it's the idea of gun violence we've talked about a lot.
Right.
And now it's been the depiction of police, because that's very much in the news.
You know, I mean, I don't think that I personally believe that there should be any rules about what you can and can't show. I mean, hopefully the project will kind of dictate what people need to see and what they don't. You know, I can't recall a movie that I saw where I felt like the violence was gratuitous, and maybe I'm just like desensitized, but, yeah.
Couldn't agree with you more.
Well, there you go. You win, Kenny. Karina, you were the deal breaker, so congratulations.
Best.
I mean, just to be clear, I'm not pro censorship. Just for our listeners, like as I'm sure they've heard Kenny and I talk about this in the past, but I do. This is a good way to kind of pivot to another thing that does feel like oddly gets censored, perhaps more in this country than violence, which is sex, and that this is a pretty sexual movie. I would argue it might be one of Spike Lee's most overtly sexual films. You know, how did you feel about that, Karina? Did you think that it was effective? Did you think that it added to it? I'm not convinced it totally did, but that's just me.
Well, there's a lot of sex in it, but I don't think it's sexy.
I agree with that.
And, you know, I think that Spike has directed some sexy stuff in the past. I mean, I think that some of the sex in She's Gotta Have It is sexy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I felt like, as I've said, you know, I think that this whole thing of the John Leguizamo character, like, not being able to control his libido is not interesting. And it doesn't feel like it feeds the story in any real way other than, you know, creating this sort of drama between him and the Mira Sorvino character. And so I think that I personally think the Plato's Retreat scene is just kind of gross. Like, it, and
right,
you know, I mean, maybe you have to see what you see in order for that fight afterwards to work. But the scene where, you know, she wears the wig and he calls her Sherry, that is, you know, really hard to watch. I don't know. I mean, I think that there's a lot of sex in this movie and its purpose is not to titillate.
I fully agree. I think it's also interesting that that on the Richie and Ruby side of things, these two people are unbelievably open about sex, and there's something actually really beautiful about their relationship. The whole kind of, I don't want to say warts and all, but just this idea of embracing someone for all of their faults and their flaws. I actually really appreciated that depiction of sex, this sort of the healthiness of it, to a certain degree. I mean, I don't know about Richie being a prostitute, but I do think that there's something really interesting about the yin and yang of those two love stories next to each other and what they say about sex.
I mean, I kind of wish that there was more of the Richie and Ruby stuff, because I feel like Spike is almost being a little too, like, at arm's length about the actual whatever is actually going on between them. It's a little too ambiguous for me. And I find it so much more interesting than, like, this guy who can't stop, like, having sex, that that I just wish that it was given as much screen time, you know, because it's like, I guess he's bisexual, but I don't think that the film, like, really deals with what his sex life with Ruby ultimately is.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Well, you know, there are a few things that strike me about the depiction of sex in these two couples. I mean, one, that the depiction of Ricky and Ruby as being functional is interesting to me when given their status as outsiders. There's this idea that they're each other's port in the storm. And it does kind of say something to me about the nature of, or at least maybe Spike's perception of the nature of romance, the nature of romantic love, which is a lot of it has to do with the situation you're in. And I think that, you know, if you kind of extrapolate that to the Vinny and what was Mira's character's name?
Deanna.
Yeah, the Vinny and Deanna relationship. Well, there's a very clear power imbalance in that relationship. You know, there's your typical kind of male privilege power imbalance. And the fact that he's, like, a good looking guy who is kind of wanted by a lot of women in the neighborhood. And given that opportunity, he takes it. Now, we've said it over the course of this podcast. I think that story's so often told, it's kind of boring at this point. Mm-hmm. I do wonder, like, there might have been an opportunity missed if he just kind of was obsessed with B.B. Newworth. I think, like, at least that would be like, all right, I could see why you're not going all in on this. I can see why you're obsessed. That in and of itself is kind of weirdly interesting. And that's also a relationship that doesn't feel like he's just, you know, screwing some girl in the front seat of his car, which is how the other ones feel. That feels, you know, a little more equitable in the power dynamic. So yeah, I wonder how much of that has to do with it, you know, kind of this comment on male supremacy, power imbalance in relationships, and this idea of port of the storm when you're, you know, outsiders.
I think there's absolutely something to that. I also think that I quite liked the scene between Deanna and Ruby in the bathroom when they were talking about Vinny's sexual preferences, and I think Mira Sorvino is really great in that scene, and it felt pretty genuine to me. What did you think of that scene, Karina?
I really liked that scene too. And I don't know, I think I had kind of, like, you know, missed if they had talked before about how Ruby had been involved with Vinny, I'd missed that until that scene. And so I found it to be an interesting way of not just like kind of dealing with a plot problem, but advancing both of those characters.
I absolutely agree. I don't think they have any other scenes together. I kind of wish there were more of them. It really, I don't know. I thought it really illustrated just two very different people dealing with a similar situation. I mean, in terms of like how they both dealt with Vinny, I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, it seems like this is a very male world. Go ahead, please. It seems like this is a very male world,
yeah,
in which, you know, most women seem to be defined by the relationships with men. And so it's not like this scene, you know, breaks from that, but it does at least like have a sense of like women being able to turn to one another, which is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that the it is a very masculine movie, and I don't know that that's necessarily a great thing, but I do like the fact that, I mean, it does seem like it's a condemnation of Vinny. Like, I don't think that this film is propping Vinny up as a good person or as a person that, I do think that they are kind of tearing him apart. So it does feel as though there's a commentary on, to some degree, on toxic masculinity within it. But yeah, I don't know. The film sort of, I mean, there's really not a ton of plot to this film, despite its 2.5 hour running time. It's like not a ton happens, but the film does sort of barrel towards a climax in the sense of Vinny and Deanna break up, and Vinny kind of goes down this downward spiral of drugs and paranoia and what have you, and his friends, quote unquote, essentially sort of incept him to believe that Vinny is that Richie is the son of Sam. Which leads him to sort of luring Richie out into the street so these guys can, you know, beat the hell out of him, basically. Which it does, I mean, it does feel like a similar situation to the end of Do the Right Thing, in terms of an act of violence that sort of brings a community together in a way. I don't know if you felt that way or not, Karina.
I don't know. I wouldn't say that I felt like it brought the community together. I feel like one of the things that's so sort of weird about that whole last sequence is that these guys, for whatever reason, are the only people around who haven't been listening to the radio or watching TV that night.
Right.
And so they're just like the only people who don't know that the actual son of Sam has been captured. And I mean, I don't know. It feels like a real plot contrivance.
Yeah. We could have done better.
Yeah, I don't disagree. That being said, I do think that this kind of crescendo of the film with this montage to, I believe it's The Who, yeah. With
this, oh yeah, I mean it's great.
It's great. It's really something. Yeah, I mean it almost makes the 2.5 hours that preceded it worthwhile to a certain degree. Like, you just find yourself being like, well, if only the film could feel like this all the time.
I mean, I think the whole movie is pretty great from the blackout on.
Yeah.
It's just getting to the blackout.
I kind of loved the end, even with the plot contrivance of it. And it kind of saved the movie to me. I mean, it reminds me of the end of a movie that's nothing like this. But have you guys seen The Mist?
No. I have not.
I haven't either.
God. Just watch it for the end. It's such a bad movie, but the end is so good. But basically, like, I just think there's something kind of beautiful and poetic about the moment John Leguizamo or Vinny sells his soul. 3 seconds later, they're like, you know, you didn't have to do that. You know, you can't put that genie back into the bottle after you've sold your soul. But like, he was so close to doing the right thing. So that like the look on his face at the end, the look Richie gives him, it's amazing. I went from kind of being lukewarm on this movie to being quite positive because of that last moment. It was a shock to me. So
yeah, the movie ends strong. Like I you know, to Karina's point, I do feel like the last, you know, I don't know, probably 45 minutes, maybe a half hour of the movie are quite strong. And this last sequence really does end on a powerful, I don't want to say exciting, but it certainly is, you know, a powerful way to end the film. I just feel like, honestly, if he had just trimmed like 20 minutes, maybe a half hour out of the movie, I think there's a good movie here. It just feels as though it kind of gets lost in its own ideas a little bit.
So ultimately, you think this, I mean, just put you right on the spot. You think this isn't a good movie? Yeah.
I think this is I think it's a flawed movie. I mean, it certainly wouldn't be in my top 10 Spike Lee movies probably, but, Karina, did you think this, what did you think? Did you think this was a good or did you think this movie works? How did you feel about it?
I mean, I think I'll just reiterate that I think there is a good movie in here, but that there's kind of, for me, there's sort of too much padding around the good movie. But I don't know. I mean, I just kind of go back and forth because I do feel like on some level it is sort of inherently racist to tell Spike that he's doing too much because we don't talk about that with other filmmakers who, you know, might be making a 2.5 hour film. You know, I just especially like going back and reading reviews of his movies, you know, dating back to school days, it just feels like I'm trying to examine like my sort of unconscious biases about his work.
Yeah, I mean, I have similar feelings. I've been rewatching, either rewatching or watching for the first time a lot of Spike's films over the past few weeks, and you know, I think he's an incredible filmmaker. I think that there's, you know, I was watching a documentary on Apple TV that they did about his work, and it's amazing how like his vision was from the jump. Like his stuff is just unbelievable from the beginning, I guess the long and short of it is I do think that a lot of people have taken him for granted as a filmmaker for a long time, which is obviously very unfortunate. I think this film has its issues, but I still think there's a lot of really positive, really interesting stuff going on in it. But we do a rating thing on our show, Karina, where we rate the films that we watch,
just like you do on You Must Remember This.
Yeah, just like that. Like that.
When you gave Betty Page like a 72, I mean, come on.
So we rate the films from 0 to 99, 0 being the worst, 99 being the highest, and we try to rate them at different times. If you saw it in 99, what you thought of the film before we did this podcast and after the podcast, just to sort of see if it's changed your opinion at all. I'll go first, just because, you know, I saw this film in 99. I saw it in the theater. I remember seeing it and being not particularly blown away by it at the time, and I probably would have given it like a 68 or something like that at the time. But I do think that through reevaluation, watching it again and doing some reading and talking with you guys, I think I'm at like a 72 now. What are your thoughts on it, Karina?
Well, I didn't see it in 99. I watched it for the first time yesterday.
Okay.
And I think I would probably give it like a 78.
Yeah, that sounds about, I mean, that's certainly close to where I landed on it. But Kenny, do you have any thoughts?
I gave it a 78 too. Before watching, I gave it a 78. And I think I truly was in like the mid 50s until the last 15 minutes. And it just kind of kicked me in the stomach in a really good way. After talking, I don't think I'm any higher. I don't think I'm any lower. I think like, I think it's a 78. I think this kind I think the only thing I would say about it in reevaluation is I'd like to go and reevaluate it again. I'd like to watch it one more time after this discussion and see now that, you know, Karina's brought so many things to light and we've had discussions about it, see if that's changed. And I haven't really said that about any other movies, but yeah, the first 2 hours are a solid 55, and then it really kicks ass for me. So,
Yeah, I will say this. I do agree with you to a certain degree, Kenny, that is a film that I do think I would go back and watch. For the first hour, I would not have said that. And now, in hindsight, talking with you, Karina, and Kenny about the stuff that's going on in it, it certainly has kind of built up its esteem a little bit more. So I certainly would like to watch it again. But so next week we have Griffin Newman coming on to talk about Muppets from Space. So yeah. I have to ask you, Karina, do you have thoughts on the Muppets?
I like the Muppets. I have not seen Muppets from Space.
Don't bother.
Wow, yeah, no, spoiler alert.
Don't bother. But I'll say this.
We're not cheerleaders for 99. We give you the straight scoop. You know? But if you love the Muppets, don't watch Muppets from Space.
You'll love this episode. Yeah. Do you? The reason I ask, Karina, is because it does feel like your classic Muppet movies, like The Muppet Movie or Muppets Take Manhattan, I rewatched or watched them for the first time over the past couple of weeks, and I'm really taken with how classic Hollywood they are. There's something really beautiful about even just sort of the classic Hollywood movie musical, but also just this, this joy that they're able to convey, this sort of, they're just really, really beautiful movies. And I just sort of wondered if you had thoughts on those early ones anyway.
I haven't watched one in so long. Okay. I don't really have any numbers.
Sorry. No, don't apologize. I'll just say this. I think you would like the early Muppet movies. They're really, really beautiful films.
Yeah, I haven't seen them since, you know, probably in 20 years, so.
Yeah, I mean, I had neither, and I was quite frankly really blown away by them, so I was just curious on that. Well, Karina, I can't thank you enough for coming on to talk about Summer of Sam with us. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thank you so much. Podcast like it, just podcast like it, podcast like it's 1999.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.